It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. The United Nations aid chief is warning that Syria is the greatest humanitarian crisis of our time, with hundreds of thousands of civilians in dire need of food, water, and medical supplies. Stephen O'Brien made his case before the UN Security Council on Monday.
The Syrian people have faced an onslaught of unspeakable violence. The reports are endless. Barrel bombs, hellfire cannons, cluster munitions, chemical weapons, thermite bombs, napalm, suicide bombs, mortars and rockets, snipers, bombs landing on schools, hospitals and civilian neighborhoods, rape, illegal detention, torture, child recruitment, sieges of entire cities, starving people to death deliberately.
O'Brien said the UN is ready to move aid into eastern Aleppo as soon as it receives the necessary security guarantees. The UN has been asking for weekly 48-hour pauses in the fighting in Aleppo in order to get aid in and the sick and injured out. Turkey is backing away from claims that a child suicide bomber sent by Islamic State carried out an attack at a Kurdish wedding, killing 54 people. Prime Minister Binali Yildirim on Monday said speculation that a child was responsible was based on rumors from witnesses. So far, no one is claiming responsibility for the attack, which has similarities to attacks carried out by the Islamic State. North Korea is making its threat once again of military action against South Korea and the United States as their annual joint military exercises got underway on Monday. Tens of thousands of U.S. and South Korean troops are training together for 2 weeks. A Pentagon spokesman says the annual drills are designed to make sure the United States can defend South Korea from communist North Korea. The exercises, according to the spokesperson, are 100% defensive in nature. This is VOA News. Two Chinese nationals will go on trial at a military court in Bangkok on Tuesday for their alleged roles in a deadly bombing at a Bangkok shrine 1 year ago. The blast killed 20 people, wounded more than 100 others at the Hindu shrine. But a year later, more than a dozen key suspects named during the investigation remain at large, while analysts say Thai authorities have yet to offer a convincing motive. U.S. Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton is responding to allegations made by her Republican rival Donald Trump and his backers that she is suffering from health problems that could be problematic should she win the presidency. Clinton poked fun at Trump's assertion during an appearance on a late-night TV show on Monday.
Well, this has become one of their themes. Here, you take my pulse while I'm talking to you.
Okay.
Make sure I'm alive.
Oh, my God, there's nothing there.
There's nothing there.
Clinton and Trump have released notes from doctors declaring them physically fit for the presidency. A new batch of emails released Monday indicates several donors to the Clinton Foundation were given access to Hillary Clinton during her time as Secretary of State. Donald Trump is calling for an investigation by an independent prosecutor outside the Justice Department.
We are going to have a new immigration screening test to keep people out of our country.
That was Donald Trump speaking about immigration, but he also, in that appearance in Ohio, talked about the need for an independent investigator to look into the connection between the Clinton Foundation and during the time she served as the Secretary of State and access to her in that office. Trump called on the Clinton Foundation to be shut down. Clinton campaign officials have firmly denied any wrongdoing, saying any decision by Clinton were made without considering the influence of donors. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has called for deployment of protection force to help stabilize South Sudan. Joe Craig has the story.
South Sudan was at the top of the agenda Monday as Kerry met with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and foreign ministers from Kenya, Uganda, Sudan, Somalia, and South Sudan in Nairobi at the start of a three-country tour. The Secretary of State announced the United States would be giving $138 million in new aid to South Sudan, which he said would be used for food, water, and medicine for those in need.
We're not just going to provide help incessantly. If they're not willing to accept responsibility and do the things necessary to deliver to their people.
Kerry also said it is urgent to deploy the 4,000-troop Regional Protection Force in South Sudan. Jill Craig, Nairobi.
I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington. More news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Opposition groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo have called for a nationwide strike today, Tuesday.
We are saying that Mr. Kodjo is becoming a bottleneck, and he has to go. And secondly, we want to tell the people of Congo that Mr. Kabila not taking care of what is going on in the eastern part of Congo.
Martin Fayulu is a member of the opposition coalition in the DRC. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry meets Nigerian President Buhari today in Abuja. South Sudan's government sets conditions for the return to Juba of Riek Machar, and a Machar supporter calls for renegotiation of the 2015 peace agreement.
All the decisions that were taken since the moment the first vice president was dislodged from Juba must also be declared null and void. There must be an independent international team of investigation to look into the atrocities that happened since the first week of July.
Lamar Cole is South Sudan's former agriculture minister. Fake and substandard drugs are becoming a serious problem in the developing world. And a new study says young people between the ages of 18 and 35 view the world with cautious optimism. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Opposition groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo have called for a nationwide strike today, Tuesday, to force President Joseph Kabila to hold elections and step down when his second term expires at the end of this year. This comes after the opposition coalition over the weekend refused to attend a dialogue with President Kabila, sponsored by the African Union and facilitated by former Togolese Prime Minister Idem Kodjo. Martin Fayulu, leader of the Commitment for Citizenship and Development Party, says Mr. Kodjo is biased in favor of President Kabila. Fayulu says the opposition will participate in dialogue guarded by UN Security Council Resolution 2277, which calls for discussions that respect the Congolese constitution.
We want to demonstrate to Mr. Kabila that the people of Congo, they don't want to see Mr. Kodjo. We want the talk to take place in accordance with UN Resolution 2277. We are saying that Mr. Kodjo is becoming a bottleneck and he has to go. And secondly, we want to tell the people of Congo that Mr. Kabila is not taking care of what is going on in the eastern part of Congo, mainly in Beni. They are killing people, they're almost a mass killing. And Mr. Kabila is doing nothing, and he just wants to stay in power.
So you don't want to enter into talks with the government because you don't want the mediator, Mr. Idem Kodjo, the former Togolese prime minister. You want talks under United Nations resolution. Who do you prefer to mediate the talks?
Anybody now, what we said is this. The international community has set up what they call a group to help the facilitator. We said to them that just transform that group to the group for facilitation with a leader. That leader can be Mr. Kodjo, whatever you want, whoever. But they didn't do that. Mr. Kodjo continued to provoke Congolese by declaring what he wants. We have understood that Mr. Kodjo, he's close to Mr. Kabila, and he wants to help Mr. Kabila to stay in power. That's what we are saying. We don't want him.
And what do you expect from the people of the DRC? What should they do for today, Tuesday?
The people of DRC, mainly the people of Kinshasa for now, they have to stay at home to let the government know that the people are not happy for what is going on, mainly about Mr. Kodjo.
You mentioned the situation in Benin, Eastern Congo. I did speak with the DRC Information Minister, Lambert Mende. I think the way he explained it to me was the situation in the East is caused by some rebel groups, some terrorists, he called them.
This massacre has been there for now long period, long time. But why they didn't say before that those guys were Islamist or whatever.
The Electoral Commission said over the weekend that the voter registration drive, which is started back in March, would not be completed by December. That means the election you're talking about may not be held, may not take place.
The Constitution is saying in the provision 7.3 that the Electoral Commission has to call the presidential election 90 days before the end of the current president's mandate. There is no place for him to say that the election cannot be held. I think for him, the only solution is to resign.
Martin Fayulu is the leader of the Commitment for Citizenship and Development Party in the DRC. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Visiting U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting today, Tuesday, in Abuja with President Muhammadu Buhari. Relations between the two countries are believed to have improved since President Buhari took office last year. As Chris Stein reports from Lagos, Secretary Kerry is expected to discuss areas of economic, security and corruption-related cooperation between the two countries.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is expected to meet with President Muhammadu Buhari in the Nigerian capital Abuja before heading to the northern city of Sokoto to speak on tolerance. Council on Foreign Relations fellow Matthew Page says the visit comes amid warming relations between the two governments.
I think overall the relationship remains sort of near or at sort of a high watermark in recent history.
It was not always this way. Officials in former President Goodluck Jonathan's administration complained the U.S. was not selling it weapons that could be used to fight the Boko Haram insurgents in the country's north. That conflict has killed about 20,000 people and displaced up to 2.7 million. U.S. officials say concerns about human rights abuses by the Nigerian military have affected their ability to sell weapons to the country. American surveillance drones based in neighboring Cameroon are assisting a task force of troops from Nigeria and neighboring countries fight the insurgents. A small group of American troops is also present in the northeastern city of Maiduguri, according to a senior military official who spoke on condition of anonymity. That city has long been a focal point of the insurgency. Another area of collaboration is the fight against corruption, which is seen as one of the main reasons why two-thirds of Nigerians live in poverty, despite the country being one of Africa's top economies. Buhari vowed to crack down on looting during his campaign for president last year. Since he took office, Page says the United States and Nigeria have slowly been ramping up cooperation to recover stolen money.
They haven't really developed a deep sort of investigative cooperation or information-sharing relationship. And I think what we're seeing, or what we have started seeing, you know, over the last year, is that that relationship sort of pick up.
This visit will likely be the last by a U.S. cabinet secretary before President Barack Obama steps down next year. Page says if Kerry makes any major announcements during this visit, they will likely have to do with stopping graft.
He may announce that the U.S. has levied a handful of visa sanctions on individuals that were involved in corruption and vote rigging during the 2015 elections.
Also on the agenda will be the economy. Nigeria is poised to enter a recession thanks to drops in the price of oil and a fall in the country's crude production. Page says the United States could offer technical assistance for development projects or help Nigeria borrow from international lenders. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
South Sudan's former minister for agriculture says last August's peace agreement should be renegotiated by the signatories. Lamako says President Salva Kiir has violated the agreement by forcing former First Vice President Riek Machar to flee South Sudan. Accord says the proposed regional protection force for South Sudan should also be mandated to protect South Sudanese politicians so that they can speak freely in South Sudan.
The regional force should be deployed in Juba to create a conducive atmosphere for the politician to talk. In addition to providing security for the people in Juba, it will also provide an enabling environment for the political groups to discuss the future of the country. Second, all the violations of the agreement since it was signed, such as the imposition of the 28 states, the reconstitution of the Transitional National Legislative Assembly, all these must be abrogated, they must be reversed, they must be revoked. Third, all the decisions that were taken since the moment the first vice president was dislodged from Juba must also be declared null and void. Finally, there must be an independent international team of investigation to look into the atrocities that happened since the first week of July.
You were saying that you also want the Transitional National Assembly to be reconstituted. You were talking about the 28 states to be revoked. These are issues that are too close to the heart of the ruling SPLM. Does that mean the peace agreement has to be renegotiated?
The 28 states is not in the peace agreement. The peace agreement talks about 10 states. The Transitional National Legislative Assembly, it speaks very clearly about who should be there. So if these are close to the hearts of the people you have mentioned, the agreement is even closer to the hearts of all the South Sudanese.
The government in Juba will bring an argument that what they have done is to save the peace agreement from collapsing, because they will say someone like you and other members of the SPLM-IO fled from Juba, saying that their life is not secured. So they will say they will not have to wait for you.
We did not flee from Juba, for your information. I did not flee from Juba. These things happened when I was outside Juba. But since the peace agreement was abrogated by none other than the president himself, then what do I go to Juba for? The first vice president was attacked and he was made to withdraw from Juba.
Dr. Lam, I would like to put this question to you. This is a question that a lot of people are asking me outside here. They are saying, are South Sudanese politicians really serious about the suffering of their people? If they are serious, why are they not bringing an end to these problems?
Well, you ask the president. You know, we all of us were optimistic when the peace agreement was signed, and that even if it did not satisfy all the demands of everybody, so people were optimistic that peace will come. But the president has his own agenda, and he's the one who is taking the people back to war. So the responsibility lies squarely on his door.
Do you foresee any end to this standoff? Allow me to call it that way.
If the government in Juba sees sense and then it does what every South Sudanese want them to do, the situation will return to normal. If they don't, then they will have to be pushed out. There's no other alternative.
Lama Cole is South Sudan's former agriculture minister. He was speaking to John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today's Tuesday, August 23rd. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17:30 past the hour. South Sudan's Information Minister Michael McQuay says the cabinet has decided that former first vice president in the transitional government of national unity, Mr. Machar, must stop practicing politics and denounce violence before he can return to Juba. But former Education Minister Nyamba says the conditions are unacceptable. Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Information Minister Michael McQuay says the Council of Ministers decided on Friday to set conditions for Machar's return. He says Machar's presence in Juba led to the last month's deadly violence in capital.
If Riek Machar wants to come back to South Sudan, then he should denounce violence so that we don't go back to war, because it is his coming here which created this violence. Number two, he should abstain from politics until that time when election comes, because what he wanted is to be the president. And to become a president is not taken by force. It is through the ballot, not the bullet.
Former Minister of Education Peter Nyaba says Machar should be encouraged to return to the capital with no conditions.
We will not accept this because he's our leader and he's South Sudanese. And how can he stay in exile? It's a very, very stupid kind of condition, you know, somebody who does not want peace.
McQuay says President Kiir's appointed ministers are waiting for the SPLM-IO to decide whether they want Machar to resume his position of first vice president. Taban Dengai, the new first vice president, said at the SPLM-IO meeting over the weekend that Machar should stay in exile.
So this is our message, you know? Let him be in peace where he is, and let him go to any of his countries of his choice.
Deng says Machar's return to Juba could cause more violence, but did not elaborate. But Nyaba says the condition expressed by both McQuay and Deng are meant to, as he put it, water down the already staggering implementation of one-year-old peace deal. Nyaba says the agreement cannot be implemented without Machar's participation.
Dr. Machar is a very important factor in the peace process itself. You cannot implement the peace process without him. In fact, what Taban, McQuay and those of Salfakir did was really, you know, to destroy the peace agreement itself. And Salfakir has been clear from day one that this agreement would not be implemented because he does not want to share power. He wants to maintain this totalitarian regime based and or driven by ethnic nationalism.
McQuay insists the government is committed to implementing the peace agreement with the new SPLM-IO leadership. but worries that Machar's return would interrupt what he calls the smooth implementation of the peace deal.
And the implementation of the agreement is moving well. We don't want it interrupted, but we want to continue with the implementation of the agreement so that our people can live in peace and harmony.
Late last week, Machar and a small group of SPLM-IO appeared on the border of South Sudan and Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN mission in DRC transported the group to an undisclosed location in DRC. Machar's next move is unclear. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Fake and substandard medications are a serious problem in the developing world, potentially harming patients who desperately need medical treatment. So, a team of researchers has developed a simple, inexpensive, paper-based test to identify bogus medications. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Many countries, both in the West and in the developing world, are awash with counterfeit and ineffective drugs. But chemists in those countries do not have expensive instruments to test whether a pill is genuine. So instead of a $30,000 machine, scientists have developed a $1 paper card that can test a suspect drug in 3 minutes to determine whether the medication is inactive or of a substandard quality. The tests come in 20 test card packets. Some of these drugs have been deemed essential by the World Health Organization for the treatment of infections in the developing world. The drugs include antibiotics ciprofloxacin and ceftriaxone. Chemist Mario Lieberman of the University of Notre Dame in Indiana helped develop the inexpensive test.
Really, this touches on issues of basic fairness and justice. If people are paying for medicine, they deserve to get medicine. And so this is the project that we've been working on.
Lieberman says the card can be used to test a wide variety of medications.
This card is designed to test antibiotics and tuberculosis medications, but it also works for some other drugs. So, for example, for some diabetes medications and heart medications. And that kind of drug for chronic conditions is becoming a lot more important in the developing world.
To test whether a medication is genuine, the researchers crush a pill, rubbing the resulting powder across 12 lanes on each card. Each lane contains a test for a separate ingredient. The card is then dipped in water for a couple of minutes. Chemicals on the card react to the powder and turn a particular color, which is compared to a color pattern from high-quality pills from a drug manufacturer. The process sorts out active from inactive and even harmful ingredients such as heavy metals from the powder. The researchers tested antibiotics from Western Kenya and Uganda and found between 10 and 30% of the medications were of poor quality. Undergraduate student Susan Bleasey of Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, helped develop the drug test card, which was unveiled at the annual meeting of the American Chemical Society. Bleasey says it's important to flag fake drugs at every level of a healthcare system.
It affects the patients that are supposed to be receiving these medications and then not getting the treatments that they're supposed to be. It affects the caregivers, such as the pharmacists and doctors that are prescribing these medications, because it starts to make them question their confidence in the medical system. And then it affects the buyers that buy it directly from the manufacturers, because they start to question the quality of the investment that they're making into this pharmaceutical.
While the cards are used to test fake and substandard drugs in the developing world, Lieberman says they may eventually be used to check the integrity of herbal medicines and nutritional supplements in the West and even illegal street drugs. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
A new global survey finds that millennials, or young people between the age of 18 and 35, view the world with cautious optimism and embrace a value system that is largely progressive. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the World Economic Forum's Global Shapers Annual Survey in Geneva.
More than 26,000 millennials from 181 countries answered the survey in 9 languages. A diverse group of young people participated, including CEOs, students, police officers, well-off individuals, and slum dwellers. The World Economic Forum says the results provide unprecedented insight into the thinking, priorities, and concerns of young people from all regions of the world. Adeyemi Babington-Ashe heads WEF's Global Shapers Community. He says the results indicate young people view the world as having many opportunities, with technology playing a pivotal role in creating jobs. He says they are bound by a sense of unity and shared destiny. He says a recurring message in all regions is the enthusiastic embrace of technology, but with caution.
Although they embrace technology, it is an overwhelming percentage said that they were either concerned or very concerned about privacy. More than 70% said they avoided downloading applications for privacy concerns as well.
Young people across all regions see corruption and a lack of government accountability as the most pressing problems in their countries. They expect their leaders to be action-oriented and act with honesty, humility, and transparency. On a global level, the survey finds millennials see climate change as the most pressing problem affecting the world, followed by large-scale conflicts, religious conflicts, and poverty. Babington-Ashe says analysts were surprised by the large degree of empathy millennials have toward refugees. He says 67% globally have a positive view of refugees.
So not only do they have empathy, but 73% would welcome refugees to their country. And you can see it grades down to their city, their neighborhood, and we even have 22% saying they'd welcome refugees to their home.
The survey finds laptops are favored for emails and online shopping, while the smartphone is the number one device for social media activities. Globally, it reports 53% strongly support same-sex marriage, while a majority of young people in the Middle East and Africa disagrees. Overall, 50% of participants say they believe they can contribute to shaping the decision-making in their countries. However, that number is markedly lower in Europe, where only 44% say they believe they can influence the process. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. South Africa's main opposition party has won control of the local government in the economic hub city of Johannesburg for the first time since the end of apartheid. The Democratic Alliance's candidate won the post of mayor in an election by local government councillors following heavy losses by the ruling African National Congress, ANC, during August 3 municipal elections. The win is one of several for the Democratic Alliance in urban areas, including taking political control of the capital, Pretoria, in election last week. Hundreds of Nigerian protesters marched on Monday to the presidential villa in the capital, Abuja, to demand that the government do more to rescue more than 200 girls kidnapped in 2014. The protest comes a week after Islamist militants from the group Boko Haram released a new video showing as many as 50 of the kidnapped girls. The militant group said several girls have died and demanded a prisoner swap for the rest of them. That's it for this Tuesday, August 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Next on Straight Talk Africa. How do you think Africa fared at the 2016 Rio Olympics? Chaka Sali and his guests will review the 2016 Olympics. That's next on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. Some things change, some remain the same. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC GMT right here on VOA Africa.